Welcome back, everybody. It's good to see your faces. So today we are in the week where we started the book of Bamidbar, and as you likely know, the books of the Torah are named by what we call the first significant word in the first verse. And that's true also for the Torah portions. So we're starting the book of Bamidbar, which means in the wilderness, or in the Midbar is desert. And the Parsha, the Torah portion, is also Bamidbar, in the wilderness or the desert. So we'll get back to those names in a minute. Just a review of the whole book of Bamidbar itself. It's a transition from the books of Genesis and Exodus, where our people, we witness miracles like the Exodus and the crossing of the Red Sea and the giving of the Torah at Mount Sinai. And in Bamidbar, we transition to a life of journeying, of trekking through this Midbar, through this desert. That isn't to say we weren't already on a journey, but the stories and the details focus much more on journeys than big miraculous events. And the journey is from Egypt, from slavery in the past, what's happened. Those are the first two books of the Torah, and now we're transitioning to a journey to or towards a life of future values, laws, and growth that will take place along the journey, and then the projected growth once we transition into the Promised Land, into Eretz Yisrael. And Sefer Bamidbar alternates between law and narrative. If you sort of follow a mapping out of it, it's giving of laws and then some narrative of the journey and then more laws, and that's just sort of the flow. God is the principal actor, even more than people and individuals. And God has to maintain the covenant that was affirmed at Mount Sinai through a lot of challenges and provocations and frustrations that we, the people, challenge God with. And finally, overall, this journey is both a physical one through the Midbar, through the desert, and it's a spiritual journey. From Mount Sinai, from taking on the covenant and the Torah. It's the spiritual journey from there to the Jordan River, where we're looking over the land where the received laws and values will be lived out. So that's the book, that's the big story. So now our parsha, our Torah portion, is the beginning of the book of Numbers, chapters 1 through 4, verse 20. And as I mentioned, it's called Numbers because it's called Bamidbar because that's the first significant, so to speak, word. But in English, it's called Numbers because, first of all, in our parasha, there's two censuses, and we'll mention them a little bit later. And there's a lot of counting, and there's mathematical things such as design and configurations. So that's where, partially the word, the name Numbers comes from in English. It's not a translation of Bamidbar. And it begins very, very specifically. It says the following happened, which is a conversation between God and Moshe, at the beginning of the 13th month since the Exodus. So it's the very first of the first month of the second year since the Exodus. So it's sort of a new year. So it's very specific and special. And God says that you're going to say all this to the people on this very specific date in the tent of meeting. And the tent of meeting is not specified exactly where it is. So it's sort of a very specific time and a very more generalized place. This place of sacred meeting, you would think the opposite almost, that the important thing would be, you know, where is this place? How does it measure up to the traveling and all that? And it's not that way. So let's go first to the census, because that's the first thing that's said in this conversation, which takes place in this tent of meeting, is God says, take a census to determine the purpose of the census. Is it's all males between a certain age, and the purpose of the census is to determine the size of the population that could bear arms. So this is in preparation for the journey. And Ramban says that the census is a lifting up. And actually, it doesn't say count these people. It says se'u et rosh, lift up the head of every person. So the counting is a head lifting up. And what does that mean? So Ramban likens it to someone who has precious jewels, and from time to time they go through them and they hold them up and they say, oh, this one is so precious and it's so beautiful. And I, you know, I remember when this one came into my possession, and oh, look at this one. And I know this is the one I wear for special occasions. And look at the beautiful light that shines through the prism of this one. So counting is to acknowledge, to recognize, to really see. So when we're counted in a census, at least in this context, we're really being seen. And it's an affirming of the other's dignity as well. So that's chapter one. Chapter two is the physical regulations, the preparation for traveling and stopping to camp. And that runs into chapter three, which is, chapter two talks about, you know, following the pillar of fire and the cloud, and when to stop and when to start. And then in chapter three, there is a very detailed and long list of how the people are to be organized when they start marching forward. So it's not like, you know, a rally in downtown Boston where everybody is moving forward in a big crowd. It's like that in that it was, you know, 600,000 people, but everybody had a place in this march. And then when people settled, when they camped in the evenings, they had to be in a certain arrangement. So I am going to attempt to screen share and just quickly let you see the diagram of, oops, where'd screen share go? Here it is. So do you see that diagram? So these are the names of all the tribes, and there's 12 of them. So there's three on each side of this. I always thought of it as a square, but I guess it's a rectangle, because here's the Mishkan, the tabernacle, in the middle. And when it's set up, it's a rectangle. So, and these groupings around the tabernacle are all from the Levites, the sons of Aaron, and then the other sons of Levi, all the priestly persons, priestly groupings. That's, one family from the tribe of Levi, and they surround the tabernacle. They're the ones that carry it when it's being transported, and they're the ones that are there to perform the rituals that are necessary and to be a buffer of protection. And you can see it's kind of faint, but this says E for east, south, west, north. So they all have to be in relationship to the tabernacle and all facing a certain direction, and that's how they march and how they camp. So I'm gonna unscreen share. Do you see anything on my screen now? No. Okay. So the reason I want to show you that is that the encampment configuration, which, as I said before, is really a lot, it's long, it centers the ark, it centers the tent of meeting. So basically, the holiness and the place where God is met, however you understand that, is in the center. And in the book of Exodus, we learn the words that we were singing earlier, Ve'asuli Mikdash, make me a tabernacle, Vishachanti Betocham. And as we've heard, there's an understanding of those words that if you make this Mikdash, I will dwell in you. But the literal is, I will dwell among you or among them, because God's talking about the people. And so this is a physical manifestation of that in some ways. And it helps the people to become a harmonic community that's integrated and connected by a shared purpose of walking together, but also then they begin sharing goals and values and becoming a community. The chapter 3 is a listing of the lineage of the Levites, and it includes the ceremony for redemption of the firstborn. It's called Pidyon Bechorim, which literally means redemption of the firstborn. We call it Pidyon HaBen today. And then chapter 4 is the second census of the Parsha. It's a census of all male Levites from the priestly clan, ages 30 to 50. And that was necessary to determine what the priestly workforce was and to give all those different assignments around the ark, etc. So, Rabbi Yoel Kahn says, he's a contemporary of ours. In fact, I went to rabbinical school with him. He says that this very first sentence I mentioned that gives the precise date of or time of this conversation, and yet the place for this Mishkan is Bamidbar Sinai, Ohel Moed, it's in the wilderness of Sinai, in this tent of meeting. That the sacred place of encounter is not attached to any particular place. It's always in the midbar, though, always in the wilderness. So why the midbar? Rabbi Kahn continues, the midbar starts out as a physical frontier, and in fact, it's not in the Torah, it's not a place of just sand dunes. It has agriculture that the animals that are with the Israelites can feed on. So it's a place of some sort of nurturance. But ultimately, it's a spiritual state. Our deepest, most authentic encounters happen when we are able to let go opening ourselves to the I thou of full meeting. Another interesting thing about the word midbar is that if you take away those vowels, the letters can also form the word midaber, which is speaking, from the verb lidaber, to speak. So it's a place of speaking. And we could think about, what is speaking? Is it the human heart? Is it God speaking to us? Is it nature, the climate, speaking to us? What is speaking in the midbar? It's a place that's accessible to everyone, to people with, in the case of this parsha, with people with no land of their own and few possessions. It starts out as a place that is a spiritual journey of our deepest and most authentic encounters, when we are able to let go and thereby open ourselves up to whatever meets us. It's unspoiled and unorganized territory, and in some of the things that I read, instead of wilderness, Midbar is translated as wildness. Rabbi Larry Kushner writes, Midbar is a place of no hiding, a place of truth, openness. The desert is actually a way of being, and it is only the way to begin. A place that demands being open to the flow of life around you, that demands being honest with yourself without regard to the cost and personal anxiety. A place that demands being present with all of yourself. Your possessions cannot surround you. Your preconceptions cannot protect you. Your logic cannot promise you the future. Your guilt can no longer place you safely in the past. You are left alone each day with an immediacy that astonishes, chastens, and exalts. You see the world as if for the first time. In the desert, the Midrash on this portion states that one needs to make themselves hefker, ownerless, open, like the wilderness itself, in order to receive what is spoken to them. That is why the Torah is given in Sinai. And Rabbi Kushner adds that the Torah was given in the desert because there and only there we might be able to encounter the mystery. So what is the connection to meditation? To our practice. I imagine that many of you have thoughts about this. I'll just share a few with you and then we can have a little time for discussion. So back in Parsha Lech Lecha, where way back in Genesis, where God says to Abraham, go, Lech Lecha, go to leave your father's house and everything that's familiar and go to the land I will show you. There's this going without expectations and just to be open, to allow yourself to be surprised. And in fact, it's true of all the forefathers and of all the people that went out of Egypt, that they were Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph, and Moshe were all sent out to go to a place that they did not know, whether it was going out to find a wife, or it was going to make a living for yourself, or it was going out to look for your brothers. They were all sent to a place they didn't know, leaving what was familiar to them, and eventually leaving that known world behind. So when we move forward, when we take a journey, we leave our preconceptions behind. We cannot set out for the Midbar without bringing with us those that have come before us, which is our past, but we can't stay there. And bringing the past with us is perhaps symbolized by Joseph's request that his bones be carried, by the people that would be leaving Egypt. And we can't, in this journey, we can't know what the future is. So we really are being in the present as we journey. Aviva Zornberg continues this up by saying that the journey's crucial experience is through displacement. We leave specifics, our land, home, family, our attachments, such as the landscape of our basic self-awareness behind, and we shift to the indeterminate, the non-specific, the land I will show you. We need trust and faith for that in the journey, in the guide, and in the self. You only know that you're there when you know it. Lastly, I'm going to read something from one of my teachers, Sylvia Boorstein, from her book, Pay Attention for Goodness Sake. A journalist asked her once in an interview towards the end, what's supposed to happen from meditation practice? So she wrote, what's supposed to happen is that our vision becomes transformed. We begin to see with increasing clarity how much confusion and suffering there is in our own minds and hearts. And we also see the ways in which our own personal suffering creates suffering in the world. We also get to see the extraordinariness of life, how amazing it is that life exists and continually recreates itself in an incredible, spectacular, mind-boggling, lawful way. Seeing that way makes it impossible to do anything other than address the pain we note and attempt to heal it. Our hearts become more responsive. We become the compassionate people we were meant to be. That's the whole point of the practice. So I'm going to leave you with two questions for our discussion or anything else you want to bring up. So question one is, Sylvia mentioned that she saw a plaque on her very first meditation retreat that she carried the message with her still. And it read, life is so difficult. How can we be anything but kind? That's so Sylvia. And so my question is, what do you imagine it looks like for you to live a life with God or holiness or at the center? And my second question is that Kushner and others say that Torah was given in the Midbar because we need to be open to what is around us and to be totally self-honest, being present with your whole self. How does your practice help with this?